All right, hello everyone. I'm Stephen Downs, and welcome to the session, which is Introduction to Social Constructivism. And I'm hoping, right, that's probably better for you, isn't it? Okay, I'll share my screen. Or probably better, if you click on my screen in your Zoom, you should see me and see my slides. So,
if you can see you, but your slides are not, we can't see your slides. Have you started sharing your slides?
I did. Okay, I see what's happening. Okay. So I'm just...
your slides are blurred. We can see you clearly.
Right. Okay, the slides
are blurred. But we cannot see your slides.
All right. So let's share the slides then.
Yes, now we can see the slides and we can see the slides. And then you're on a different screen where we can see you too.
All right. Good enough. Okay. So here we are, and I'll just blow these up so that they're nice and big.
Recording in progress.
Okay, and now the recording has started and we're actually official now. Welcome to this presentation on social constructivism. This is an introductory session. So I'm not going to go deep into the issues. The idea here is to provide an overview and maybe a bit of experience on what is meant when people talk about social constructivism. Way too many S's and V's in this in this title for my comfort. Got it. The content is being okay, from current slide. Ow, crying out loud. It's sharing on the wrong screen. So you're probably, okay, stop share. Okay. Share screen. There we go. Nice and big. That should be better for you.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so the way I'm going to do this, I've got some videos to show you. I've got some examples to show you. There's a place where we can have some conversation. I know there's not a lot of people here, so the conversation probably won't be wide-ranging. And I have some exposition or explanation for you. So let's begin with that. So, constructivism is responding to what might be called a transmission theory of learning. And in the diagram here, we see an example of the transmission theory of learning. Okay, the in the transmission theory of learning, the one person, typically the teacher, has a concept that they're trying to transmit. They will encode it, usually into words, although sometimes pictures and other things. And then the receiver, the student typically, will decode it and thus form the same concept that the teacher was trying to transmit. And then you'll verify that through perhaps interactions, the typical Michael G. Moore theory of transactional learning, or you might verify that through testing of some sort. to make sure that the student has the same concept that the teacher was trying to transmit. Constructivism criticizes this perspective. It suggests, and convincingly in my mind, that students, or people generally, construct new understanding and new knowledge through experience and social discourse. And that experience includes people talking to them, just like it includes me talking to you, but it also includes their other experiences of the world. For example, their own experiences of cats, say. In constructivism, new knowledge, new content, whatever you want to call it, is integrated into what is already known. And it's thereby extended. So a person, you know, if the teacher is talking about a cat, the person might already have a preconception of a cat. Perhaps that preconception includes mice. And so they will, through these experiences, construct or build or create a model in their own mind of whatever reality the instructor is trying to get across. So it's a process that happens in the student entirely. It's not a case where the instructor transmits the entire knowledge, but rather whatever is experienced is integrated into previous knowledge. We see a distinction already between this and the transactional theory, because the transactional theory doesn't really include a role for prior knowledge and integration of knowledge. However, how this new knowledge is integrated is very much a matter of interpretation. I've got two alternatives here that you can see on the screen. On the one hand, we have a cat and a mouse in a model being imagined by a student, and the cat is chasing the mouse, which is what you might expect. But on the other hand, we could have that very same set of concepts, cat, mouse, person talking, and the cat and the mouse are getting along. And both of these are, if you will, supported by the evidence. Or more accurately, which interpretation we're going to choose or develop is very much a matter of the student's background, their previous knowledge, their cultural knowledge, etc. And that leads us to social constructivism. As you can see, I'm just zipping right through this. And social constructivism argues that human development is socially situated. And so the constructions or models of reality that we create are constructed through interaction with others. So we don't do it all by ourselves, right? And that kind of accords with common sense. You know, very often people say that learning is a social activity, and this is how and why learning is a social activity. So we have the process of interaction. People bring in their different experiences of cats and mice, etc. We have a conversation, or we go through an activity together. And as a result of that, we create a common social construction, which will be our shared model of the world. Now, practically, we can't just go straight from interaction to model, because we are out there working in the real world. So what actually happens is we have our interactions with each other, and we create artifacts. One such artifact is language. We create language through a process of interaction, and we use a shared vocabulary, cat, for example, or mouse, and together we all collectively create these artifacts, and then these artifacts stand as a representation for the model of reality that we're working with. Now, there's very often a distinction drawn between social constructivism and social constructionism. And I'll just draw that here. We're focused on social constructivism. And that focus is on the artifacts or the constructs that are created through social interactions. But very closely related to social constructivism is social constructionism, which is focused most of all on the activities and the interactions that take place. And it's not so worried about what the artifacts are, except for the fact that there need to be artifacts that are constructed. It's more about how we interact together, how we build together, how we construct together. I personally think of these as two sides of the same coin. And you can treat constructionism and constructivism as two separate theories, but really they kind of go together, and it's really hard to have one without the other. So how does this happen? Well, here's an example. It's an example of, building an ontology. And so people would get together and build relations and structures between things in the world. Here, for example, is an ontology of pizzas. Has spiciness, has topping, etc. Here's another ontology, and this one is an ontology of membership and reporting to, can you figure out what that is? Probably. Think about it. Changed by sub-organization. Something to do with business, I guess. Here's another one. Topic of homepage. Interest, theme. This looks like it might be the ontology of an online account, etc. So, and that's how this works, right? We get together, and together we might use an application like this, or we might just work with paper, and we'll construct our model or our representation of the world. Oops. Okay, that's my version. And now I'll give you somebody else's version.
So what is constructivism? Well, let's look for clues. Constructivism, constructa, construct, construction. Constructivism is about construction, the construction of reality and knowledge. It stands in contrast to positivism's assumption that there is one reality out there to be discovered just as it is, and objective knowledge out there to be gained. Constructivism looks at the interplay of forces that bring reality and knowledge into being. Constructivism is a term applied in different ways at different times in philosophy, sociology, and research. It is also sometimes used interchangeably with constructionism and social constructionism, so nailing down what it is exactly can be difficult, but we'll try to get a general idea. Constructivism's ontology, or understanding of being, is generally classified as relativist. There is not one reality. Rather, there are many relative realities, specific to and co-created in the context they are part of. A constructivist would likely say that my reality will not be the same as your reality, because we have each constructed our realities together with our communities, our societies, and other forces. It is not just people and our cultures, conventions, and institutions that constructivists see as forming reality. Rather, the interaction between people as individuals or groups with the physical world around them construct reality. Constructivists generally, therefore, do not deny the existence of a world outside of human perception. Rather, that external world has a place as one of the forces that bring reality into existence through interaction. Constructivists believe that objects have existence, but not meaning, outside of human perception. The epistemology or understanding of knowledge in constructivism is often classified as a relativist one, though not as fully relativistic as some perspectives. This relativism is not to be bemoaned, though, as positivists may be tempted to do. Rather, a constructivist sees the varied, nuanced understandings that different people bring into being as enriching our knowledge of the world. And within these varied perspectives, there are still criteria for getting to truth. For constructivists, meanings are not all equally valid. There is not one right or objective meaning, but meanings vary on how relevant or fulfilling they are. Their value can be informed by how attentive they are to the object they reflect, or how well they balance the dialectical process of mediating the interaction between subject and object. As researchers, constructivists may take many paths. However, they all acknowledge the role that subjective experience and values play on knowledge in the research process. Many will attempt to harness these opportunities that arise from subjectivity.
So that sounds like pretty skeptical, but there's no real contradiction between constructivism and realism. And this is an image that illustrates this really nicely. Think of the object in the middle as representing reality. Well, reality is looked at from different points of view or different perspectives. And these perspectives here are represented by the shadows that the object projects onto the walls around it, or the floor. Viewed from one perspective, the object looks like a square. Viewed from another perspective, the object looks like a circle. Viewed from yet a third perspective, the object looks like a triangle. So we can see right off hand that even if there is one reality, we can still have different perspectives. Now, what's interesting here is that our perspectives of this object can go above and beyond the object itself. And that's what this video was trying to hint at a bit. For example, we look at this, we look at these objects, and we ask, well, what could this object be used for? The technical term for that is affordances. What are the affordances of this object? And, you know, if we see the circle, we might think, well, we could use it as a stopper for a drain. If we see a triangle, we think, oh, we could use that to wedge under a door to hold it open. So based on our perspective, our understanding of this object goes beyond what is simply there, out there in the world. And so there is a sense that you can have realism with constructivism, and there is also a sense in which the constructive approach or the constructive model takes us beyond what is simply out there. And that's because We're not simply mirroring reality in our mind. We're not simply getting knowledge that is transmitted to us. We're working with it and integrating it into models. And these models are what define things like affordances. Well, how do we ground these models in reality? Well, there are different perspectives on this. One perspective is what might be called the logicist perspective. And the logicist perspective will say that, you know, our perceptions or interpretations of reality may vary because we each have a different point of view, but there are some objective truths or principles of facts and reason, for example, mathematics or logic. 1 + 1 is always 2. A deductive argument is always deductive. And so, sure, we can have different perspectives on the world, but these perspectives, these models, have to align with the principles of mathematics and logic, and indeed can't go beyond them. We can't go in a non-logical way from our experiences to, as some people say, castles in the air. There are different ways to approach this. Immanuel Kant, for example, talks about the necessary a priori, or another way of putting it, the conditions for the possibility of perception. How is it possible for us to have experiences at all? And he says, well, we have to have space, and we have to have time. If we don't have these, we can't have experiences. Kind of makes sense. So that is where you begin to ground your constructions and your models based on your experiences. Chomsky, by contrast, says that syntactic structures or the nature of language and grammar is built in as a necessary structure. And so our language itself is a guarantee of reflecting the fact of the matter, the truth about the world. Or we could look at human development and how we experience the world through our own individual development, the transformations that we go through in different stages of development as described by Piaget. Another type of approach is the scientific perspective. And again, we could talk for days about this, but the idea here is that science is a social process, not just an empirical process. It's not just about observing the world, but it's a social process that takes the models that we come up with, a weather prediction, say, which are composed of a theory of the world, or a model of the world, and our actual observations, and we subject this to testing and confirmation in a public forum. And this is the whole concept of peer review in science, right? You can't just come up with a scientific theory and say, ha, I've done it. Your scientific theory is reviewed and tested by other scientists out there in the world. There are different approaches to this. Karl Popper, for example, proposed the logic of falsification, right? So the idea of science is some people come up with theories and then the rest of science tries to falsify that theory. Van Frassen talked about constructive empiricism, where we do collectively construct models of the world, but these models are still grounded on our experience and the physical phenomena that we see in the world. Radical constructivism, by contrast, does away with the objective reality. And I'll admit, I'm more partial to this than the others. It says that even if there is an objective reality, might be, might not be, that objective reality is beyond our reach. All we have are the different perspectives. And we can work together and construct an objective reality, but there's no reason to believe that what we've constructed is or is not actually representative of the world that's out there. So let's think about that.
Vygotsky's social constructivism. Vygotsky's theory of social cultural learning highlights the role of social and cultural interactions play in the learning process. This theory does not have stages like Jean Piaget's theory. Vygotsky's theory states that knowledge is co-constructed and that individuals learn from one another. It is called a social constructivist theory because, in Vygotsky's opinion, the learner must be engaged in the learning process. Thus, for Vygotsky, learning happens with the assistance of other people. A fundamental aspect of Vygotsky's theory is the zone of proximal development. This is a range of tasks that are too difficult for an individual to master alone, but can be mastered with the assistance or guidance of adults or more skilled peers. Another part of this theory is scaffolding, which is giving the learner the right amount of assistance at the right time. This implies that if the learner can perform a task with some assistance, then he or she is closer to mastering it. This theory is relevant to healthy adolescent development because if students work in pairs, they are interacting with people and therefore can learn different academic ideas from one another. This theory shows that students learn from each other. They can assist one another and co-construct knowledge. Vygotsky's social constructivism can be applied in the classroom in several ways. For example, the students can be grouped such that the students who understand the content work with the students who do not. For instance, if a student did not understand factoring, a method to find the zero or zeros of an equation, the teacher could have another student explain the concept to them. Here, the more knowledgeable peer might use different language than one did as a teacher. In this way, the student's phrasing might make more sense to the other student. The more knowledgeable student would also learn something, perhaps a deeper understanding of the content, or a way to explain the concept that they had not thought of before. Students of different readiness levels will work together in groups when they do discovery activities, such as problem-based learning activities. In Vygotsky's social constructivist approach to learning, the groups would consist of at least three students, and they would be given a problem that would challenge them all, and as a group, they would have to solve the problem. The teacher then would set up the activity such that it allows for everyone to contribute some ideas as to how to solve the problem before any method is attempted. Vygotsky's theory differs from that of Piaget in a number of important ways. First, Vygotsky places more emphasis on culture affecting cognitive development. This contradicts Piaget's view of universal stages in content development. Vygotsky does not refer to stages in the way that Piaget does. Hence, Vygotsky assumes cognitive development varies across cultures, whereas Piaget states cognitive development is mostly universal across cultures. Second, Vygotsky places considerably more emphasis on social factors contributing to cognitive development. Vygotsky states the importance of cultural and social context for learning. Cognitive development stems from social interactions, from guided learning within the zone of proximal development, as children and their partners co-construct knowledge. In contrast, Piaget maintains that cognitive development stems largely from independent explorations, in which children construct knowledge of their own. For Vygotsky, the environment in which children grow up will influence how they think and what they think about. Third, Vygotsky places more and different emphasis on the role of language in cognitive development. According to Piaget, language depends on thought for its development. That is, thought comes before language. For Vygotsky, thought and language are initially separate systems from the beginning of life, merging at around 3 years of age, producing verbal thought, or inner speech. For Vygotsky, cognitive development results from an internalization of language. And lastly, according to Vygotsky, adults are an important source of cognitive development. Adults transmit their culture's tools of intellectual adaptation that children internalize. In contrast, Piaget emphasizes the importance of peers as peer interaction promotes social perspective taking.
Oops. Oh no, that's right. So, the recognition that social and cultural factors, including the development of language in a society or in a culture, impacts our view of theory. Where by theory, what I mean is the way we develop the models or the constructions of reality in our own learning. The traditional theory is based on an empiricist model and is grounded in fact and observation. It is what the logical positivists argued in favor of. And they would say that a theory begins with observations, our experiences of the world, that are encoded into an observation language, and then using only the principles of mathematics and logic, which we know are correct, right? You construct your model or representation of reality from that. And that model or representation is used to make predictions, and then you test your model or representation by testing those predictions, whether they come true or whether they don't. And the reason why you have to do this is because for a given set of observations, there are multiple different representations you could have. The mouse might chase, or the cat might chase the mouse, or the cat might get along together with the mouse. So you construct the different versions of reality, the different models, and then you test them. And it's all very objective. The language that we use is, as they say, theory neutral. It's specifically and only based in observation terms. Well, and that's where the criticism comes in. Because this traditional approach fails to analyze the broader social context. Language, to take an example, is not just based in observations and deductions from observations. Language is a complex social phenomenon. The terms that we use might refer to things that we've seen exist in the world, like mice and cats, but they might also refer to things that we've never seen in the world, like genies, or I don't know if you've seen ghosts or not, but or mass. And so when we use language to create these theories, or when we use any sort of social artifact to create theories or ideas or models of the world, the traditional approach fails to analyze and look at that broader social context. So we have an alternative approach called critical theory. And critical theory actually reflects on the origin of the theory. And by that, what we mean is the origin, for example, of the language that we use to express the theory, the way we measure objects or events in the world, what counts as evidence, what doesn't count as evidence, what counts as a problem, what doesn't count as a problem. And then beyond that, critical theory aims to be a transformative force within that context. It's trying to shape theory into something that responds to what might be called deforming social effects of on theory. That was a bad way of phrasing it, but for example, critical theory will try to find insights in the forms of power and domination that exist in a society. Colonialism is a classic example of that, or race is another example of that. That can identifying the way these inform our theory, if we identify how these inform our theory, then we can act to correct theory to resist those forms of domination and power, and do so in a way that can, as it says here, inform practical action and stimulate change. What counts as an observation isn't theory neutral, it isn't power neutral, it isn't culturally neutral. It's based very much on who has the power in a society to say this is an observation, this is not an observation. And so part of social constructivism in education is giving people or helping people develop the tools in order to be able to develop a critical understanding and critical appraisal of theory. So that takes us to the practical application of constructivism. And it's a change not only in the way we look at what knowledge is, but it's also a change at how we look at what are the structures of power, control, and agency in the classroom. And so the role of the teacher changes from being an instructor to more of a facilitator, helping people construct their own knowledge. The teachers or instructors or facilitators need to learn about the students to understand their own context. There's a shared authority and responsibility for learning. And because it's social constructivism, there's a focus on interaction, especially in small groups, to allow people to create their own knowledge.
Constructivism in education. It is important to understand how teachers can apply constructivism inside their classroom to create a unique learning environment for students. In constructivist classrooms, the teacher has a role to create a collaborative environment where students are actively involved in their own learning. Teachers are more viewed as facilitators of learning than actual instructors. That is why teachers must work to understand the pre-existing conceptions and understanding of students, and then work to incorporate knowledge within those areas. In constructivist classrooms, teachers will also need to adjust their teaching to match the learner's level of understanding. The constructivist classroom relies mainly on four key areas for it to be successful. First, shared knowledge between teachers and students. Second, shared authority between teachers and students. Third, teachers act as a guide or facilitator. And fourth, learning groups consist of small number of students. Constructivist classrooms are often very different from normal classrooms in many ways. This is because constructivist classrooms focus more on student questions and interests. Here, a constructivism classroom builds on what students already know and focuses on interactive learning. A constructivist classroom is also student-centered, where teachers have a dialogue with students to help them construct their own knowledge. Constructivist classrooms, therefore, often have teachers who do small group work, collaborative and interactive activities, and open dialogues about what students need in order to find success. As we can see, in a constructivist classroom, teachers create situations in which the students will question their own and each other's assumptions. In a similar way, a constructivist teacher creates situations in which he or she is able to challenge the assumptions upon which traditional teaching and learning are based. Educational theorists believe that at the constructivist level of knowing and thinking, students continually re-evaluate their assumptions about knowledge. Their attitude towards the expert is transformed. Students are not troubled by ambiguity, but are enticed by complexity. And students take on a never-ending quest for truth and learning, where truth is seen as a process of construction in which the knower participates. For this reason, a constructivist teacher's perception of expertise in the classroom is based on the experience of his or her students in interaction with each other and with their teacher. Some education scholars believe that holding a constructivist view of knowledge enables the teacher to explore and form new ideas about teaching and learning. This explains why in a constructivist classroom, teachers are viewed as individuals who are often drawn into teaching by a love of kids.
So, there are criticisms of constructivism, and we'll look at these briefly before we finish the session. I'm not going to play this video. I'll leave this video as an exercise for you. These slides are available online, and you can watch this video. But I want, you know, if we were doing this, and it's hard to do it with an online presentation format like this, but if we were doing this session in a constructivist mode, what we should be doing now is engaging in a discussion about some of the questions that might come up in constructivism, and especially social constructivism. So I'll leave that as an exercise for you, but whoops, that's not what I wanted to do. There we go. I want to have us think about these questions. The first criticism that we see in that video asks us whether our experiences really tell us how or why something works. For example, we may have the experience of putting gasoline into a car and then getting in our car and driving away. But the argument is there's nothing in our experience that explains why this works, why we would do this, what it is about gasoline that makes the car go. And that's a, you know, what do you think about that? Then ask yourself, is there a way in the methods and processes that we've talked about so far to actually achieve understandings about how something works or why something works? Another issue is the proposition that in constructivism that knowledge can't be transmitted through language. On the face of that, that seems false, doesn't it? I mean, look what I'm doing now. I'm using language, and I seem to be sharing information with you. So how is that working if that can't happen in constructivism? You know, when children or people generally engage in constructivist pedagogy, there's a potential for novices to uncritically digest false knowledge. And even if they're working together, the assumption that truth will prevail seems especially dubious in a constructivist classroom, according to this criticism. So what do you think? You know, this is a point for you to have a discussion. Is there a way in a classroom for people to actually come up with something that is true? Another question that comes up is, if all knowledge is subjective, then arguably we can't differentiate between science and pseudoscience. If every model is equal, one model is science, another model is astrology, they're equal. There's no way to distinguish between them. Or is there in a constructivist model? Another response to constructivism is the problem of peer pressure. Get people into a group and tell them that 2 plus 2 equals 5. And if you have enough people saying 2 plus 2 equals 5 around you, that's a lot of pressure on you to just simply agree that 2 plus 2 equals 5. Even though you may know that it's not true. So the question is constructivism something that allows that? You know, I mean, are our analyses of power simply obscuring the fact that we're setting up a new kind of power relation? And then finally, and we're experiencing that right here in this classroom, the phenomenon of cognitive load. So people, various people, John Sweller most notably, have the idea that when we're absorbing information, digesting information, we can only digest it at a certain rate. And if we're doing too much extra stuff, like having conversations, for example, and talking about whatever and considering all kinds of alternative theories, that's too much work for us in order to get to having the knowledge in any reasonable sort of time. And the example would be, imagine if in this session we had had a discussion of what is constructivism to start with. We would have had that discussion for a little bit. We might have gotten to slide 1 on our own, but we probably wouldn't have gotten anywhere beyond that. And at the end of the class, we really wouldn't know very much more about constructivism and social constructivism than we did when we started. It's not very efficient. But if we tried to speed up the process, that'd be too much for people to do. You can only do so much. So the recommendation is you use a transmission mechanism, much like I'm doing here, and just give people the information, and then they remember it and they know it. Now, I personally think that there are responses in social constructivism, and indeed the responses to all of these have been contained in the presentation that I gave. I think that we look at these two slides of criticisms, we can actually go back to the previous slides and find the response. But I'm going to leave that as an exercise for you. I think there are answers to all of these criticisms. I think you can probably find them if you work together and look at and consider what you know about constructivism, especially from your different perspectives and your different experiences, you can probably find the answers to these questions. How do you learn, for example, about how gasoline powers cars? How do you, as an individual, resist peer pressure? How are you able to learn things when you talk to other people, even though that's inefficient? I think the answers are there. But I'll leave it to you to find these in a properly constructivist way. I think I've tried to set the stage, but now I turn it over to you. And we've got about 5 minutes. Are there any comments, questions, anything like that?
Recording stopped.
Nothing?
How do we use social constructivism in online environments? Online learning.
Yeah.
A small groups of mentioned.
So, in online learning, from a social constructivist perspective, what we're most interested in is supporting the mechanisms that allow us to have these interactions so that we can get together and create models or representations of the world. So we use tools that allow us to have these conversations. For example, Zoom, like this, except we wouldn't just use Zoom to present sessions like this one. We would use Zoom to have a conversation where you just set up a topic ahead of time and have people come to the Zoom conversation with their own ideas, their own perspectives, and then have a facilitated discussion about that. And by facilitated, what I mean is that there's a person in the room who is able to lead people to have that conversation. They might ask questions, they might encourage responses, etc. Similarly, for people who don't like or can't use a video conferencing system, online it's very common to use discussion boards. A discussion board or even a social network will serve the same sort of function, where people have their own perspectives and add their own perspectives into a common environment where people are able to interact. But again, as we know, just throwing a whole bunch of people at a social network doesn't really produce any sort of order. And more often it produces chaos or you know, the as they say, the dumpster fire that is Twitter. You need people in that environment and in that conversation who are able to guide it. And they guide it first through moderation, because some people will just try to wreck the conversation. They don't want this kind of knowledge to be happening, and these people need to be moderated out. But also, a good facilitator will lead people to find conclusions. They'll do things, for example, like identify where one person and another person said basically the same thing. They'll highlight disagreement between them. Or they'll help people draw conclusions, you know, much in the way that I tried to do at the end of my session, right? They'll pose questions and help people try to draw conclusions from what they've seen. So those are the sort of techniques that you would use in an online environment to try to promote a constructivist approach to learning.
Sarah, go ahead, Tom.
I just want to say thank you, Stephen and Manisha, for this session. I'm sorry I came in half an hour late. I don't know whether I flubbed the initial information about when it was to occur, but I missed the first half. But I do appreciate what you are saying, Stephen. I find the constructivist approach persuasive, and I do think, too, that there are questions about it that would even come out of a constructive approach, a self-criticism, which is what you were raising at the end. And I think those questions can be answered as well. I try to teach from this point of view. I find it particularly helpful in my area, although I've retired now, but I still do a bit of teaching. I'm in the world of archival studies. I was an archivist. I taught in the master's program in archival studies at the University of Manitoba, educating students to be professional archivists. And the constructivist approach to understanding the world is very, very helpful to archivists, it seems to me, because implicit, as you were saying, and not implicit, explicit, is the idea that means of communication shape what we can know. And that transforms, you know, picking up another term you were using, or the video was using, that transforms our understanding of those means of communication and thus of archives.
Recording in progress.
And, I don't know how much you may know about the world of archives. And I don't want to go on and on and on. I just want to sort of reinforce what you're saying, and that is that archivists and archives have been misunderstood, undervalued, invisible, kind of marginalized in a lot of things, in the footnotes, in the credits at the end, you know, which screen roll past fast at the end of a film or whatever. The whole film is dependent upon archives. And yet if we focus on the means of communication, on the way things are constructed, then you do have to step back and think about archives, yeah. Libraries, galleries, museums, education, and so on. It is a way of really rethinking things, and it's not easy. It's complex. And I'm not suggesting I have all the answers to it either, but I think I've helped introduce students to the way to thinking about this so that they can continue this process. But as you were saying, I think in one of your critiques, you can't just, you know, have everybody start out with a group discussion based upon what you may know, as if that's going to educate them in any way to continue the social constructivism approach or to function well. You know, I find because archives are so unusual, the students, when they start out, many of them have never been in archives. You got to sort of give them stuff to think with. Yeah. And then you can start seeing how it's constructed and how they can continue to construct. I've gone on at length, but it's simply because I want to emphasize how much I appreciate what you're saying.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. First of all, there will be a recording of this, so you can go back and get the first half if you need it. And don't miss the first half. I did some nice stuff,
okay.
If I say so myself. Secondly, not only do I agree with you, I would add that understanding learning this way gives you new methods of learning because you're no longer just dependent on somebody transmitting information to you. You are able to actually work in the environment, including the environment of archives, and use that in order to construct or create new knowledge. And I think that's really important. One of my favorite activities is going to a city and trying to learn about the people of the city by touring around the city. And when you put it that way, how else would you learn about the people of a city except by touring around the city. And that's the takes us to the third point, where you don't just throw people into a conversation. I really think that the experiential part is important. And the classic constructivist approach is to give people an experience and then have them talk about it. I like to express it as, learning is practice and reflection. So you have them try to do something and then talk about why they weren't able to do it, as is usually the case. And so, yeah, you don't just give people a blank piece of page and say produce knowledge. That would be craziness.
Yeah. And I think too, just to follow up on that, when I say that in many cases in the world of education, whatever the subject, the instructor does need to give something to get things going. But as long as the instructor says, be critical of me too. Don't, I'm trying to give you something to get you thinking, but don't take it as gospel. Employ your critical thinking upon what I'm saying, and hopefully the instructor is open to that. That's really important as well. And I think a better outcome will come as a result. And you've emphasized that.
And that's, that's the understanding knowledge from the perspective not just of the contents, but of the power and the social structures that produce it. And
Yes.
agency, I think, is as important as anything in learning and development.
Yeah. Thanks very much again
Well,
for
thank you
the
for
issue.
joining us.
Sarah England is using chat because her mic is not working, and she posted two comments. Thank you for sharing about a rather complex model. I'm not a teacher, I make exhibitions. But it makes me think about how people learn, have social experiences, come to conclusions in exhibition spaces. So instead of thinking of an exhibition as a means of transmitting knowledge, how can we think of it as a space for co-producing knowledge, guiding learning, facilitating conversations in social space?
Yeah, great question. Great question. And I would tie that in with where we finished off with the previous question about having experiences. Putting people into a common environment and having them share an experience, first of all, gives them something in common to talk about. But it also preserves each of their individual perspectives because everybody comes into it with a different background and everybody has a different experience of whatever that common experience was. So maybe running them through a game, maybe running them through a simulation, maybe showing them a presentation, short presentation. Maybe having them try to build something. You see in a lot of these seminars where, you try to build stuff out of straws or spaghetti or whatever. And then that's the first part. And then the second part is being able to facilitate that discussion to help, as the term was used, to scaffold it a bit. So, for example, if you take constructing with spaghetti, the questions that you could ask them could lead them to reflect on, what are the strengths, what are the engineering strengths of spaghetti and how is it weak? Or the questions you ask them could lead them to think about how did you work together as a team? Ask yourselves, was there one person who took control? Did you listen to everybody? Those sorts of things. So the experience and then the reflection on the experience, having these in a group and then scaffolding or supporting this experience and the discussion that follows helps the group arrive at their own conclusions. So you're not forcing the conclusions on them, and they may reach conclusions you didn't intend, but that's fine. But it helps them co-create knowledge in that way. And my experience is once you've done that a few times, then they don't need you anymore. Because they'll have these experiences and have these reflections on their own. And that's characteristic of professional teams. You see that all the time with a professional team. A bunch of strangers who have this background in education will come in, they'll try to do something, run a project, build a product, whatever, and they'll communicate back and forth and be reflective on their own process as well as reflective about whatever it is that they're doing. And they'll just know how to do that. And it's a completely different experience than just having one person come in and tell everybody what to do. Completely different. And recommended, by the way.
Recording stopped.
Excellent. I personally love, when you mentioned construct or learning artifacts and co-production, because when it comes to indigenous content in education, authentic indigenous content, we don't have. So to have students as, student authors and promote, learning where they become contributors, creators, is how we will bring authentic indigenous content for everyone, for indigenous and non-indigenous people. Like non-indigenous people, I find there were so many researchers, people who want to do projects. I had a team come and meet me yesterday. These, they look different. You cannot come in a community and just do a project. And you need to have 1,000 cups of tea with multiple stakeholders, anywhere. It takes time to build that relationship. You have a project, but who the hell gives a damn about you and your project? We don't know you.
Yeah.
I find that this constructivist approach will help us produce content, knowledge, and scaffolding and more knowledgeable other, which you mentioned. It's like Vygotsky's social cultural, culture is part of it. Sarah is mentioning more, I like the model Stephen practice experience, plus reflect. We try to do that in exhibitions through interactives, but they're often treated as special features, which would be interesting to have that as the main comp. So what do you, your framework model can be applied, archives, exhibitions. I think, personally, I love going to exhibitions. I went to Fort Edmonton Park and they had about First Nations people here in Alberta. And it was so good to have the names of elders and the quotations, because I know some of those elders. So it's good to have familiar. But the words or teachings that it's not just the residential schools, where people were fighting with each other. Anywhere where there is poverty, you have limited resources. People will fight with each other just to survive, to put food on the table, So it's really, but these are my thoughts that it's fantastic, but where am I giving that, where am I sharing my feelings with the exhibitors, just putting feedback boxes is not how people will get input. I just find that this with open education, like with online learning, that we have to use tools, these small educational tools as part of learning. We have to, maybe first year students, we may have to teach them how to create a Google alert, how to use a citation generator, CiteFast. So using, we may have to educate people about simple tools, like 5 minutes, 2 minutes, not because they don't need more time, just informing them, but not that cognitive load is so challenging, prior knowledge. I think that's fantastic you presented that cognitive load. I don't know how much is too much, how much is too less. So thank you so much. And I want to request you to do another presentation, and you can do it in January or February, about connectivism, because then it leads to, after constructivism, the connectivism. And I know that's your topic of expertise also.
Yeah.
Think about it,
Well, we'll schedule something.
January, end of February, whenever you have some time.
Yeah. Maybe end of January, I think, might be good. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, then thank you, Tom, for being with us. And thank you, Sarah. I think it's really good, you know, I think it's really good you bring in the exhibition, like exhibits. I've taken my children wherever we go when they were small, like to all these museums. And I think it's fantastic knowledge and I really value it. And also thank you so much for bringing the, not just the education or philosophy or sociology, but also, you know, your practice, public museums, you know. Exhibitions. I think that's so good. Thank you. I'll do a closing prayer at the Cultural College. It's also end of the year, and I'm very grateful. You know, I'm really grateful that you shared knowledge with us, and all of us contributed, and you proved social constructivism by having questions and a discussion, and a very active discussion. So it's a 1-30-second prayer, and when we pray, we remove our glasses here in musketry. Notavinam se manto savahininam. Whenever we conclude a conversation, we say exhale moistas, which means that's it for now, till we meet again later. And we never say bye in plain script. And also, one of the topics, you know, I'm always interested in is language revitalization. Like 3 years ago, you had someone from your department speak about machine learning. And if you can coordinate another session about language, you know, what work is being done and update. I think it was 3 years ago they presented. So I'm sure there have been updates in language revitalization too. Yeah, because next year is our 50th anniversary for our college, and and you know what, it's really nice to learn about new trends in indigenous language revitalization. Thank you. Exe. Moistas.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.